Hi, and welcome to the March 24th, 2021 edition of The Talking Show. My name is Steve Cato, and as ever and as always, I am here with my co-host, Nicholas Miller.
Feels good to breathe the air with you, Steve.
Yeah, well, you know, we breathe a lot of air when we are in the sculling session in our boat.
It's true.
So it's nice to see you and be dry. I think that's maybe, there's always a little bit of water at the bottom of the boat, and it's just one of those things that you, you know, when you love rowing.
Yeah, and the water that gets at the bottom of that boat, oh, they don't clean it out enough.
Well, and you know, and what are you going to do? It's a boat. The facts are in, folks.
I was thinking they should put some drainage holes in there.
Yeah, just I'll pass that up the chain of command. I'll let Coach know. As
Miller,
everyone
Miller
knows,
thinks
of course,
we need holes in the bottom of the boat.
As everyone knows, USC is not only a place for great academic work, but also. Not just a place of great athletics, but also where the finest minds are gathered, where we are innovating and disrupting the concept of boats by putting holes in the bottom of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we do at USC, where we are prized athletes.
And, you know, just for clarification's sake, our boat is named Chronic 2000. And that is because it is funded by our generous funder, Dr. Dre.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Dre. Also, one of the shadow funders of this radio station.
I don't think we should say that on air, Steve.
Well, you know, what do we have to lose?
Yeah. Well, don't tell.
So anyway, that's us in the rowing scene. What else has been up with you this week? You were out in the desert for a while visiting your ancestral lands.
Yeah, I went. My family doesn't hail from that part of the desert, unlike Andrea Zatel. yes, I was seeing my parents, who are recently retired from the labor force. A good position to be in if you can get it at the moment. Excuse me. And taking in the air and meeting up with my co-host Steve and his lovely wife Meredith.
Oh yeah, no, it was lovely to see you out there. You know, it's a shame we couldn't have recorded a talking show while we were there.
Well, but, we had to hustle back for that doozy last week. Sorry again about that.
Yeah, that's all right. You know, it's a good thing helicopters are so reliable and fast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Also, you know. Things have really changed around here since we got that generous shadow funding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true. And helicopters have gotten a lot cheaper since the Kobe Bryant thing. So,
yeah, true.
And making up for a lot.
And, you know, we're floating to the top of the economy, Steve and I, because this is, even while most of the service sector was completely gutted, by the COVID-19 novel coronavirus pandemic, Those of us who have these golden voices cannot be replaced by the artificial intelligence.
No, and the chit-chat industry is forever.
It's true. It's true. And did you have a good time in the desert, Steve? Did you get any cycling in?
Yeah, it was a kind of a miserable cycling. It was very windy. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, you do, as you would know from rowing, you know, you don't always love doing the sport. You know, it's not given to you to have it just be purely pleasurable all the time, unfortunately. But it's at the same time, it's those moments of sort of adversity where you you really do feel, I don't know, like that something cool is happening for you. You know, it feels powerful. And then for having survived, you get to pat yourself on the back and say, like, aha, I did it, you know? So, you know, it wasn't the most benign. Today, for example, in Los Angeles, back in Los Angeles, I did my customary ride up through Griffith Park, up over the hill, past the observatory. And because of the winds, it was remarkably clear, and I could see very, very far. I could see quite far out to sea, actually, from up there. And, you know, it was beautiful. And it's also, you know, it's rained a little bit in the last little while, so it's very lush and verdant and green. And I don't regret a moment of it. So sometimes it really does come through for you, but other times you just sort of like go uphill forever, which is something that definitely happens when you are cycling in Joshua Tree National Park from the 29 Palms entrance back towards the Joshua Tree entrance. So you just go uphill, and you just keep going uphill and going uphill and going uphill. And then you go uphill and you go uphill some more. And then sometimes you do that into the wind. And that is, and there's nothing to do. You don't have any options. You actually just have to keep, you know, like, cause what are you going to do? Walk, you know? So you just got to keep going.
You're like cycling in an M.C. Escher drawing.
It feels like that. It feels like it will never, and then it ends. And then you get to Skull Rock and you just go downhill. Yeah. But, anyway, has there been any exciting European football?
You know, I was worried you'd ask. It is a very exciting time of year. It is the, you know, we're at the quarterfinals of the Champions League, Europe's premier tournament, that all the teams compete for, all players trying to get on a team that has a slot in that tournament.
I see.
But it's an off week this week. And it's a dreaded period for European soccer fans. It's called an international break. It kind of sounds like a long commercial break or something.
Yeah.
But this is where, you know, they give the professional club players like 2-3 weeks out of the year where they can go train with their, you know, their country teams.
I see. National teams. Because like they would normally be in a situation where like, you know, like if you're playing for Madrid or something like that, you can't possibly go home to Ghana and work with the team or whatever. So you would have to like take off to, so this is your two, but then during that time, I guess it's dreaded because let me guess, no, there is no soccer.
There is soccer, but it's all international friendlies.
So like you train while sort of performing with your nation.
Yeah, but it's like you know, in the World Cup qualifiers do take place during the international break. So South America right now is qualifying. Uh-huh. So there'll be like, you know, Uruguay will play Chile, which is will be like a lively match where people are trying.
Yeah.
But otherwise they seem to schedule it like England will wallop Belarus. Like that's like the international friendlies are usually like that. You're like, why did they schedule England versus Belarus? I can imagine why.
Right. Yeah. There's no reason to watch England versus, like, of course they would just assassinate some, you know, Montenegro or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So that's like, that's how a lot of it is. And those are not worth watching and mostly just the international coach trying out the new squad, to see what he or she is going to use in the European context this summer in the Euro tournament, which happens, you know, between World Cups. So all the European nations will play each other in a World Cup like tournament this summer, which is a big deal.
Uh-huh.
So there, you know, there's pressure to make your final selections.
So the Euro Cup is on.
It's on. Yeah. It was supposed to be last summer. So,
right. Okay. I understand. So everything has just been pushed back a year.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess not oddly enough, even though it seems like in Europe, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout has been rather complex and fraught.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's...
We wouldn't know anything like about that here in North America. We've never seen... That's never happened to us.
Yeah. Here, it seems a bit like a Bruegel painting. Like they're just lobbing vaccines everywhere.
Yeah.
But then not telling anyone how to get them.
And just hope and like hoping that your specific fiefdom doesn't get caught with your pants down. I think that's the
true.
That's the vibe.
But they haven't in the soccer press, European soccer press, they have not mentioned COVID-19 in months, which makes me think that I think there was a lot of people were upset that the players were getting it before, say, health officials or whatever. But it did seem to be that way. So it was kind of like hush, hush, don't talk about it. Now, you know, England's not worried about traveling to Ukraine or whatever this week, wherever they're going.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Because, like, so, like, that's all over. It's all over so far as they're concerned now.
Yeah. Also, amongst the major teams, like, it seemed like every player got it during the last year. And they all would, but, you know, they would just go out for the recommended time, 2 weeks. And the excuse was just that they're, you know, they're quite the human specimens in terms of immune resistance and physical capabilities, so that it had very little effect on them, which seemed kind of peculiar to me. Like, none of the players would get violently sick, but I don't know. That was how it shook out in the media.
That is odd.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is really odd. Yeah. Although, I mean, I guess I was reading an article that, like, COVID-19 among athletes is, like, largely asymptomatic, for example.
Okay, yeah. And they were getting tested, like, every 10 minutes. I think twice a day for a while there. So.
Yeah.
And, you know, if papayas were testing positive and you get tested twice a day, like, chances are at some point over 6 months you're going to test positive.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Crazy.
It felt to me like, you know... one of the teams I followed closely, you'd see like a player go down, but it was never like six players got it at once. I mean, that happened on a couple teams, but for the most part, I was like, it feels like they're just kind of parsing out the positive or like the results. Like, they're like, okay, we can handle to not have this guy for 2 weeks. He's positive, but who knows? Who knows? I look forward to Mike Davis's tell all on European soccer and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Oh, God. I don't think he's a fan.
Oh, yeah, I highly doubt it.
But it'll anyway,
be Simon Reynolds.
Yeah, totally. It will always be Simon Reynolds, either writing about soccer or the fall. But
Lady Gaga and Liverpool.
Gaga. Lady Gaga. But indeed, that's so. I guess we're looking at two very different. We've discussed several really different sort of shapes of labor. You know, being a athlete, an amateur athlete, as we are competing for the rowing crew for USC.
Mm-hmm.
Being pro athletes, being soccer players.
True.
And being retired, which is sort of another version of this. One thing we haven't really discussed is how the robots, automation, and technology in general has in fact saved us from the COVID-19 pandemic, and how it has delivered us from having to do dangerous work in situations that are, you know, manifestly COVID unsafe. How automation and smart technology has led to a seamless vaccine rollout. I thought it would be an interesting time to sort of check in with sort of a noted watcher of the robot scene, to see how are all these magical wonders of technology working? You know, we all benefit, of course, from this fantastic economy that's gaining in sort of efficiency and power just through its sheer technological might. I hear that artists are just making AIs now just for kicks.
Yeah. I thought I saw Walter Benjamin in the hallway. Is he on the show tonight? Yeah.
No. So we have another denizen of Berlin, though, Aaron Beninav, here to both plug his book and to tell us what a great job the automation has done through the COVID-19 pandemic. So here we go. Let's have Aaron on.
According to many analysts, the coronavirus crisis is providing us with a sneak preview of our coming digital future. As the virus spreads around the world and lockdowns proliferated, shops were closed and people stayed home. Robots like this one, taking care of patients in a hospital in Antwerp, supposedly carry the burden in the wake of humanity's retreat. This narrative about a fast-arriving digital future clashed with another narrative about essential workers, or as they're known in Germany, the everyday heroes, who have continued to work crucial jobs for low wages throughout the coronavirus pandemic. Here's Chris Smalls, who was famously protesting a lack of protective equipment at the Staten Island Amazon warehouse and lost his job there for doing that. So which of these stories is true? Did robots save us in the crisis or humanity? To what extent are technologies transforming work in the midst of the pandemic? These questions, which have been asked again and again in the past few months, are the latest versions of questions that have been on people's minds in the US for quite some time and broke very strongly into the public with Andrew Yang's breakout presidential campaign. So are we heading towards a largely automated future? And what would human beings do in that case? Would we be able to adapt our institutions to realize a dream of human freedom that a new age of intelligent machines seems to make possible? Or would that dream turn out to be a nightmare? A new automation discourse, which has been on view again during the crisis, asks just these sort of questions and arrives at a provocative conclusion. These are just a few of the many titles coming out around this topic. So these authors say that in one variant or another, that mass technological unemployment is coming, and it must be managed by the provision of universal basic income, since large sections of the population will lose access to the wages that they need to live. Do the automation theorists have the story right? It's certainly true, in my view, that the resurgence of the automation discourse today responds to a real global trend. There are too few jobs for too many people. Chronic labor underdemand manifests in a number of trends, not only in a higher average rate of unemployment, but also in trends like this one. This is just a graph from the Economic Policy Institute. Now, you know, a little bit outdated because it doesn't cover the current crisis, but what it shows is the increasing length of time after each recession to restore the level of jobs that existed right before the recession started. So this is the process of what's been called jobless recoveries. That's one economic trend. Two others I'll show you later, stagnating real wages, and more broadly, rising economic inequality. And of course, these trends around jobs intensified dramatically during the present year. You can kind of see, if you look at this graph on the left-hand side, this is the just the unemployment rate taken from the Fed for the past, you know, since World War II. You can see on the left-hand side, the spikes are actually kind of thinner. And that thinness of the spikes is the fact that the economy recovers pretty quickly after a crisis. People lose their jobs, but then they get them very quickly back. And then as you move to the right, you can see the spikes kind of widen. And again, that's that same process of jobless recoveries, taking longer and longer for the economy to recover. And then, of course, on the far right-hand side of this graph, you see this very high level of unemployment, 14.7%. During 2020. And this, of course, the highest rate since the 1930s. And it doesn't even include many of the people who dropped out of the labor force and therefore were no longer counted. So some Chicago Fed analysts say that the true unemployment rate in April, May was around 30%, not 14.7%. So these are some of the economic trends. But labor under demand is equally visible in the political phenomena that rising inequality catalyzes: populism, plutocracy, and the rise of a seasteading digital elite, more focused on escaping in rockets to Mars than on improving the lives of the digital peasantry who will be left behind on a burning planet. Both Bezos and Musk, pictured here in a BBC documentary about their space race, have, of course, made gigantic fortunes during the corona crisis, even as most Americans continue to worry about their futures. And so pointing with one hand to the homeless and jobless masses of Oakland, California, depicted here on the left, and with the other hand to the robots staffing the Tesla production plant just a few miles away in Fremont, it is easy to believe that the automation theorists must be right. However, as I will argue, the explanation that they offer, that runaway technological change is destroying jobs, is simply false. There is a persistent under-demand for labor in the United States and Europe, and even more so in countries like South Africa, India, and Brazil. Yet its cause is almost the exact opposite of the one identified by the automation theorists. Today, I can only take you through a small part of this argument, which is the argument for my book, and talk about some of the consequences as I see them. The book's coming out on November 3rd, and you know it has some really great virtues. First of all, it's very short, and second of all, it's not very expensive. So you should check it out if you like what I'm saying. In any case, at the beginning of the book, I start off by looking at the manufacturing sector for a few reasons to test out the claims of the automation theorists. First of all, manufacturing is the sector most amenable to roboticization. Second, as you can see here, we have these measures of the extent to which robots have actually been installed in factories. And you can note here, this will be important in a moment, that the United States is not really at the front of the pack here, right? Countries like South Korea, Singapore, Germany, and Japan have way more robots per worker in manufacturing compared to the United States. The other reason to look at manufacturing is that according to the automation theorists, this is the sector where the robot apocalypse, the robot jobs apocalypse has already taken place. And it's certainly true that as the automation theorists predict, the world has seen unfolding waves of deindustrialization. What you can see here, this is the percentage of the workforce in different countries that's employed in manufacturing. And you can kind of see these waves of deindustrialization depicted by countries like the UK, Italy, South Korea, and even poorer countries that hardly industrialized at all have been deindustrializing. And just because it's commonly asked in this context, you know, what about China? Isn't China this incredible manufacturing powerhouse? And of course, it has been. But even China is experiencing deindustrialization. So for now, about 7 years, the share of the Chinese workforce and industry has been declining. And India had a very slight uptick, but now, again, a very slight downtick. So what do the numbers show? What's the cause of this trend? What's the cause of deindustrialization across the world? I'll focus on three countries just briefly now, Germany, Japan, and the US. And these are just the rates of growth of different economic indicators. So I'm just starting off here with the numbers on the right. These are the growth of employment in manufacturing, different periods in US, German, and Japanese history. And what you can see is that as the automation theory predicts, we see declining rates of employment growth. And already by the 1970s, pretty sharp year-on-year declines in employment. So that part of the story is true. If this were a story about increasing productivity, if it was a story about replacing human beings with machines and that happening ever faster pace, then we would expect that productivity growth in manufacturing would be rising at a very rapid pace. But when we look at the numbers, we see that productivity growth has been steady in the United States, and those numbers are actually contested. We can go into that in the questions if you're interested. But really strongly, if you look at Germany and Japan, two countries which have much more roboticization in manufacturing than the US, we see a pretty significant decline in the rate of growth of productivity. So if rising productivity isn't the cause of the story, what is? I say that the real cause is this dramatic fall in the rate of growth of output. This is like the growth of basically the industrial sector of the economy. It was like if you had GDP, but just for industry, what you'd see is this pretty sharp decline in the rate of growth of the industrial economy. And this is basically the real cause, I would say, of deindustrialization, of this decline in manufacturing employment. Note that it isn't that these countries are producing less than they did before. They're producing more, but the rate at which they produce, the rate at which production expands, is declining. So we are producing more and more goods with fewer and fewer people, but not because of a rapid pace of technological change. Rather, this is due to an ever-worsening industrial stagnation. Nor is this happening just in the richest countries of the world. As I said before, it's a global pattern affecting richer and poorer countries alike. and even China is feeling the impact. What's the cause? Well, I can't go into that in a lot of detail today, but just to give you a sense of the argument, what I argue based on these numbers from the World Trade Organization, which nicely goes all the way back to the 1950s and has specific data on manufacturing, you can see that overall for the whole world, this includes China, there's been a pretty significant decline in the growth of manufacturing output or the rate at which the industrial economy expands across the world. And this is due, I think, to decades of worsening global industrial overcapacity, which killed the manufacturing growth engine of the economy. So in my view, this isn't just a matter of growing technological capacities of brilliant new technologies on the technological frontier, but also about the replication of technologies across the world, making for ever more crowded international markets. Given that the overall rate of growth of the industrial economy is slowing down, no country, no single country can grow quickly except at the expense of others, like China's growth at the expense of Mexico. And what we see is that this pattern in manufacturing then reappears at the level of the economy as a whole. On the left here, you just have the same manufacturing growth rates that I showed you before, but now they're being contrasted to or compared with the growth of the overall economy. So GDP is just the economic growth rate for an individual economy. And what you can see is that as manufacturing slowed down, so too did GDP growth. So the economy is growing more slowly. And looking now at, again, the same countries, just going through a few more data points, and then we'll talk about, you know, more fun and interesting stuff. What we can see is that in a really strong contrast to the theory of automation, productivity growth rates, which should be rising very quickly if there really were this rapid automation, instead productivity growth rates for the economy as a whole are falling. They're of course much lower than in manufacturing, but they don't show any tendency to a radical increase due to brilliant new technologies. And in a way that's very associated with that, capital, like firms are just not really investing very much. This is the rate of growth of capital stocks. So like firms' investment in equipment and buildings and software. And what you see is that that rate of investment has declined over time, period by period, in all three of these countries. So this is kind of the basis in a very telescoped way of my argument that it's slowing growth, not technology-induced job destruction, that's depressed the global demand for labor. As economic growth decelerates, so too does the rate of job creation. And if we widen our view then with this information from the perspective that the automation theorists are providing, they talk about shiny new automated factories and point us to these ping pong playing consumer robots on display in trade shows. What we see instead of that is a world of crumbling infrastructures, deindustrialized cities, harried nurses and underpaid salespeople, as well as importantly, massive stocks of financialized capital with dwindling places to invest themselves profitably. In an effort to revive increasingly stagnant economies, governments have spent almost half a decade imposing austerity on their populations, underfunding schools, hospitals, and public transportation networks and welfare programs. They did this in an effort to get the economy restarted, to revive the economy as it's been slowing down. And at the same time, as part of the same process, governments, businesses, and households have been encouraged to take on record quantities of debts, and they were encouraged to do so by falling interest rates. These trends left the world economy in an incredibly dire state as it faces one of its greatest challenges, the COVID-19 recession. Dilapidated healthcare systems were overrun with patients. Schools closed that were vital sources of basic nutrition for many children. And probably remember that in the early moment of the crisis, New York, where it hit very strongly in the US, delayed in closing down its schools because they were worried about what was going to happen to these children who needed the food they were getting at the schools. And meanwhile, the economy is deeply in trouble. In spite of massive monetary and fiscal stimuli, weak economies are unlikely to bounce back quickly from the shock. We know this because that's precisely what happened in the past. Shocks to the economy have been followed by ever more slow and tepid recoveries. And it's for this reason that, in my view, predictions of a coming wave of pandemic-induced automation rings so hollow. Although technological change wasn't itself the cause of job loss, at least this time around, automation theorists like Martin Ford and Carl Benedict Frey have argued in popular newspapers and magazines that the spread of the pandemic will hasten the transition to a more automated future. This is just one example of an article based on an interview with Martin Ford, looking into all the different ways that this is happening. Lost jobs will never return, they say, since cooking, cleaning, recycling, grocery bagging, and caretaking robots, unlike their human counterparts, can neither catch COVID-19 nor transmit it to others. Here, I argue automation theorists have mistaken the technological feasibility of widespread automation, which is itself still more of a shaky hypothesis than a proven result, for its economic viability. Undeniably, some firms are investing in advanced robotics in response to COVID-19. Walmart really has purchased some self-driving inventory scanning and aisle cleaning robots for its US stores. And expecting online ordering to continue to expand exponentially, some retail shops are testing out robotics-assisted micro-fulfillment centers to help pickers assemble orders more quickly. However, the use of these technologies will likely remain an exception to the rule for the foreseeable future, with little reason to expect demand to rise strongly following deep recessions. Few firms are going to undertake major new investments. Instead, firms will make do with the productive capacities that they already possess, achieving cost savings by shedding labor and speeding up the pace of work for the remaining workers. That is precisely what firms did after the last recession. Too often, commentators simply assume that automation accelerated in the 2010s and base their predictions for the future on this false reckoning of the past. In reality, the demand could not be found to justify such investments. In the United States in the 2010s, the US saw the lowest rates of capital accumulation and productivity growth in the entire post-war era. And this is just, again, from the Fed. They have a beautiful interface for downloading international and national economic statistics. And this is just their graph of the growth of the capital stock in the US since 1950. And you can see this really dramatic fall off in rates of investment since 2010. There's been really very little investment in new brilliant technologies in this country. So around the world, recessions associated with COVID-19, in spite of the lack of automation, in spite of the absence of these new technologies, recessions are leaving legacies of mass unemployment and underemployment from which it will be very difficult to recover. The International Labor Organization, the UN Labor Agency, estimated that in the first few months of the crisis, 14% of work hours were lost worldwide, equivalent to 400 million jobs out of a global labor force of 3.5 billion people. And long unfolding transformations in work amplified this pandemic shakeout. Over the past half century, service work has come to account for 75 to 80% of work in high income countries like the US and in European countries, and 50% of employment worldwide. Recessions usually affect services least of all. Unlike spending on consumer durables such as cars and computers, spending on services usually remains buoyant during a downturn. But as economist Gabriel Mathey has recently argued, pandemic lockdowns had the opposite effect, hitting services the hardest. As spending on services collapsed and with it the incomes of many workers, a decline in consumer demand reverberated through the economy with lasting consequences for workers worldwide. The destruction of work, as has been noted in a number of recent international institutional reports, the destruction of work has been particularly bad for women, who are overrepresented in activities such as retail trade that the lockdowns hit the hardest. Women are also overrepresented among frontline healthcare workers too, and they have undoubtedly been forced to undertake the majority of the increase in unpaid care work demanded by the pandemic, not only taking care of the sick and dying, but also minding the more than 1 billion children who were kept out of school when the lockdown started. The transition to a majority service work world, which has accompanied this story I was telling earlier about deindustrialization, and that one effect of that was to massively push all these workers into services. The transition to a majority service work world, which was already ongoing, then amplified the pandemic's destructive consequences. And I argue it will now slow the pace of the recovery. As economist William Baumol explained in the 1960s, services are in large part a stagnant economic sector. Unlike manufacturing during its heyday, services generally do not exhibit dynamic patterns of growth, driven by high rates of labor productivity and falling prices. Instead, the demand for services generally depends on spillover effects from productivity-enhancing innovations occurring in other economic sectors. So here, one thing I do in my work is I like to look at statistics not only from rich countries, but also comparatively across different world regions. And here, what I'm showing you is just, again, about how slow productivity growth is in the rest of the economy. These are three countries, Thailand, South Africa, and Mexico, where you can see that in their service sectors, almost all, and in some cases more than all, of the growth of output has been accounted for by rising employment. In a place like Mexico, where you have negative productivity growth, that's because so many people are being added to these sectors, just kind of in make-work, that the effect of their addition to the labor force has lowered the overall efficiency of service production. And so following on Baumol, I say that there's this clear link between the global expansion of the stagnant service sector and the worsening stagnation of the wider economy. After the onset of deindustrialization, which began in the United States and the United Kingdom in the late 1960s, and then came to infect much of the rest of the world in the decades that followed, after that, no sector has proven to be an adequate replacement. With the running down of the formerly robust industrial growth engine, the global economy has increasingly been left without a driver. And despite this weakening of the global economic growth engine, workers losing their jobs during the pandemic are still going to have to find some way to survive in the pandemic and, you know, whenever it emerges, the post-pandemic era. Over time, unemployment will eventually resolve, therefore, into various forms of underemployment. In other words, workers will find that they have no choice but to take jobs offering lower than normal wages or worse than normal working conditions, much as they did in the aftermath of past recessions. Those who can't find any work at all will set up shop in the global informal sector or else will drop out of the labor force entirely. As was the case following past recessions, the vast majority of the world's underemployed workers will end up in low-wage jobs in services. And services that see persistently low rates of productivity growth and pay low wages have now for decades served as the premier site of job creation in stagnant economies. Part of the reason for that is that workers' wages make up a relatively large share of the final price of these services as paid by consumers. And that makes it possible for service-based firms to raise the demand for their products by holding down workers' wages relative to whatever increases in productivity are occurring in the wider economy. So this is this kind of process of immiserating growth or immiserating job creation where workers' wages have to be held down in order to stoke job creation. And a really extreme version of this on the world scale is that you see this in small-scale family operations that comprise the world's massive informal labor force. They use a similar strategy to compete with highly capitalized firms, compressing their own household wages as much as possible to make a little space for themselves in the economy. And the effect of this situation in which the economy is running down. With the depletion of the industrial growth engine, workers are only finding jobs, or many workers, not all, but many workers are finding jobs in these low wage sectors, is that inequality is intensifying. As economists David Autor and Anna Salmons have noted, quote, labor displacement needs not imply a decline in employment hours or wages. It can also hide itself in the relative immiseration of the working class as, quote, the wage bill, that is the product of hours and wages per hour, rises less rapidly than does value added. And that's just to say that there's this general process of, well known in the case of the US, there's a famous graph from the EPI showing this divergence between productivity growth, which continues to rise, albeit more slowly, and the growth of wages for production and non-supervisory workers. This gap between productivity and wages has opened up across the OECD. So as is less well known, even in countries like Germany, especially, you know, Israel, Ireland, Slovakia, you can see this kind of set of countries at the bottom of this chart. But all throughout the OECD, you see this widening gap between the growth of real wages and especially the real median wage, so the wage of the 50th percentile worker. There's a real gap opening up between their wages and labor productivity growth. And as that gap grows, the labor share of income, the share of all income that's going to workers, is falling. Worldwide, the labor share of income fell by 5 percentage points between 1980 and the mid-2000s, as a growing portion of income growth was captured by wealthy asset holders. So this is just a bunch of data about the world and an alternative explanation in which it's not rapidly rising productivity growth associated with breakout and breakthrough technologies, but rather this ever-worsening stagnation of the economy that's responsible for people not being able to find work, and when they do find work, finding that their bargaining power and their autonomy at work is being depleted. Life in stagnant economies has therefore come to be defined by an intense employment insecurity, which is all the worse in recession years like 2020, which has been artfully represented in recent science fiction dystopias like Time Out, Children of Men, and Ready Player One, populated by a redundant humanity. I don't know if anyone has seen this. There's also this great, at least the first season was great. I didn't watch the second one. Series on that's on Netflix, a Brazilian show called The 3%, where members of the favelas compete for places in a very tiny meritocracy. So most people are scraping by, earning additional minutes of life one at a time, while the richest asset owners have amassed such large quantities of capital that they are endowed with the monetary equivalent of immortality. In my view, it's precisely for this reason that it's actually so important to reflect on today's automation discourse, not only to combat its mistaken explanation for chronic labor under demand, but also to inspire efforts to resolve the world's chronic labor problems in a utopian direction. In a world reeling from a global pandemic, rising inequality, recalcitrant neoliberalism, resurgent ethno-nationalism, and climate change, automation theorists have inspired people with a vision of the future in which humanity advances to the next stage in its history, whatever we might take that to mean, and technology helps to free us all to discover and follow our passions. As with many of the utopias of the past, these visions need to be freed from their authors' technological and technocratic fantasies as to how constructive social change might take place. I argue that we can achieve the post-scarcity world that the automation theorists evoke, even if the automation of production proves impossible. At stake is the question of what achieving an economy of abundance actually entails. So to imagine the shift from the favela world to the world that the automation theorists invoke. This is a famous Bruegel painting of Cockaigne, the land of abundance, of the, you know, peasant fantasy of the mid early modern period. So, according to the automation discourse, abundance is a technological threshold that we will one day cross. with brilliant new technologies. I think we should understand abundance differently, not as a technological overcoming, but as a social relationship that we can put into practice without needing more technological breakthroughs and while remaining within the bounds of ecological sustainability. To live in a world of abundance, I think, means to live in a world where everyone is guaranteed access to housing, food, clothing, sanitation, water, energy, healthcare, education, child and elder care, and means of communication and transportation without exception. The steadfast material security implied by such a principle is what would allow people to ask, as they do in the science fiction fantasies of automation theorists, what am I going to do with the time of my life, rather than how am I going to keep on living? Instead of waiting around for a technological fix, we can get to this world of abundance by cooperatively taking on the work that we have to do that remains necessary for our lives and that cannot be automated away. And it is, of course, more urgent to do so now than at any time in the past. In the midst of the COVID-19 recession and facing a much larger climate crisis in the years to come, we have to inaugurate the kind of post-scarcity world that the automation theorists discuss by providing every human being with access to the basic goods and services that they need to make a life, regardless of their labor contributions. Achieving this world of abundance will require reorganizing production. That's something that Harvard economist Danny Roderick has recently been arguing in the midst of the corona crisis, but I would argue that he doesn't go far enough in envisioning such a reorganization. Today, people have little say in how their work is done. Many people show up to work each day only because they would starve if they didn't. In a world where people's needs were guaranteed to be met, work would have to be democratized. Sharing out the work to be done while making allowances for aptitudes and abilities would lessen the amount of necessary labor demanded of any one individual, while also ensuring that everyone had ample free time. Anti-racist theorist W.E.B. Du Bois once estimated that, in quote, the future industrial democracy, just 3 to 6 hours of necessary labor per day would suffice, leaving abundant time for leisure, exercise, study, and avocations. Instead of making some engage in menial service so that others might make art, he said we would all be artists and all serve. And there's, of course, resonances between this vision and the vision of someone like John Maynard Keynes in his famous text on the economic possibilities of our grandchildren. The pathway to a post-scarcity world is currently blocked by a tiny class of ultra-wealthy individuals who monopolize decisions about investment and employment and have little interest in democratizing the economy. For 40 years or 50 years, this tiny elite has used the threat of disinvesting from an already fragile economy to force political parties and trade unions to capitulate to their demands for looser business regulations, laxer labor laws, slower growing wages, and in the midst of economic crises, for private bailouts and public austerity. And all of these have been sold to the public under the slogan or the call that we need to do this to revive the growth engine. And of course, as I've been showing you, these efforts have failed so far. Insofar as sections of the wealthy elite, particularly in Silicon Valley, feign support for proposals like universal basic income or UBI, which does begin to point towards this kind of transformation toward a world in which people can meet their needs, regardless of their situation. Insofar as Silicon Valley elites feign support for proposals like that, it is only because UBI doesn't threaten elite control over the levers of investment and employment. For UBI to serve as a pathway to a post-scarcity economy, the automation theorist analysis really would need to be correct. Today's low demand for labor would have to originate in a rapid automation of production. Were that the case, the main issue society would confront would be one of reorganizing distribution, with rising economic inequality rectified by distributing more and more income as UBI payments. If instead, as I have argued, labor under demand is the result of global overcapacity and depressed investment, driving down rates of economic growth, then such a distributional struggle would quickly become a zero-sum conflict, blocking progress towards a freer future. Given the opposition of elites who retain the power to throw the economy into chaos by disinvestment, we will have to get to the economy of abundance through some other means, through social movements and struggles that seek to transform production itself. Large numbers of people are already fighting against the symptoms of a long-term decline in the demand for labor, which include rising inequality, employment insecurity, austerity measures, and police murders of poor and racialized communities. Over the past 10 years, we've seen waves of strikes and demonstrations across six continents, and especially strongly in 2019, right before the coronavirus hit, from China and Hong Kong to Iraq and Lebanon, from Argentina and Chile to France and Greece, and from Australia to Indonesia and the United States. And protests have recently resurged, of course, in the US in 2020. I would say that we need to immerse ourselves in the movements that are born of these struggles, helping to drive them forward toward a better world in which the infrastructures of our societies are brought under more democratic collective control, work is reorganized and redistributed, scarcity is overcome through the free giving of necessary goods and services, and our human capacities are correspondingly enlarged as new vistas of existential security and freedom open up. Only highly organized movements that cohere internally and among each other would be able to complete this task, to synthesize or to break through, as the automation theorists say, to a new synthesis of what it means to be a human being, to live in a world devoid of poverty and billionaires, of stateless refugees in detention camps, and of lives spent in drudgery, which hardly offer a moment to rest, let alone to dream. It's true that if movements fighting for a better world fail, the best we might get would be something like a modest UBI, which governments are now testing out as a possible response to the coronavirus recession. But I would say that we shouldn't be fighting for this limited goal, but rather to inaugurate a more sustainable post-scarcity planet.
All people.
That's what they mean when they say AI, Steve.
It was all people.
Yeah, AI just means forcing people to work for less money.
It's just people.
Well, at first when I saw Walter in the hallway, I thought he was going to do his bit about, you know, the little person inside the machine.
Uh-huh.
So I guess we got that in the end. It's just the Berlin perspective.
Like the Berlin School of Synthesizers, which is just arpeggiated all. No, and in this case, it's sort of like it's always been robots.
Yeah,
the robots have always been people. Sorry, your automation has always just been a less well-paid worker.
Yeah, the robot who was writing calligraphy way back when, that was just a little person under the box.
Yeah. In this case, it's just labor arbitrage.
Yeah, yeah. Simple as that.
And that there is a large enough underclass that can just be pushed around.
Yeah. No need for an intelligent computer.
It's wild that it was that simple all along. You know? that we could be our own matrix.
Yeah, we just had to tip the scales a little bit.
Yeah, you just have to manufacture enough sort of perpetual misery that it seems inescapable, and then just let people do it for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I think what you didn't realize, Steve, is that people like their shitty jobs.
I didn't realize that, actually.
<I'm joking>. It makes them feel valued. You know, I think that the word economy at the deepest level really means a system of defining value that has nothing to do with the way that people define value for themselves.
my mind is blown. Wow.
Yeah.
What a shitty world.
Yeah.
Jeez.
You know,
do you have any question? Was there anything where you were like, wait a second, Aaron, back that up?
Oh, I mean, I glaze over a little bit when it comes to all the numbers, but yeah. That's just...
You just assume them to be true.
I just used to care about numbers, and then this last year has been quite the assault of numbers.
Fair enough.
It's really kind of exhausting. I crave qualitative experience. Give me some good old fashioned qualitative experience. I mean, I'm grateful that I didn't have any of that of the novel coronavirus, but yeah, only experiencing it mostly through numbers. It was kind of abstract and very disorienting.
Yeah, I got lost in your statement. Where did the Grateful Dead go?
Who?
Did you say the Grateful Dead?
No, I didn't say Grateful Dead. That was in the sub frequencies of what I was saying on the surface.
Were you? Wow. I experienced an auditory hallucination, like that one when whatever it is you said, I just heard. I was like, what's the Grateful Dead got to do with this?
Maybe I had a qualitative experience. Maybe, is the compression algorithm between the microphone and your headphones perhaps correcting what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. And you say qualitative experience, it just says Grateful Dead.
Oh my gosh.
Oh boy.
That would be about as dumb as a quote actual AI would be. The thing that blows my mind about all this stuff, I guess it makes sense given even the way people talk about the economy as a force of nature, a kind of weather system that we have no control over. But you know, like AI is people writing, right?
Yeah.
And like that the algorithm and AIs would run away and control us and we have no agency in them is totally bonkers.
That's like a fear.
Yeah. And the common fear, and that's, is like that it's a code that can't be unwritten or something. And like,
well,
you know,
and that it will be self-generating.
Sure. You know, and maybe it can have creative capacities or whatever, but that it's not written by humans. It seems like the main frustration. People are thinking that it's not written by humans.
Yeah. Well, and to an extent, there's parts of it that we don't have a window into, which is interesting, right? You know, like in the context where like an AI is like, oh, you know, like where it's they said that they don't understand how it does. Like, they understand what it is doing. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to try and... You showed me all these pictures, and then I'm going to, like, you know, try and make a picture that's like that picture, you know? And then I'm going to do a feedback thing where I compare my results to those results. And they don't understand the process by which it navigates those things, just that it's following these procedures, you know? But right. To my understanding, that's just like... called functional computer programming, you know, like, mm-hmm. like where you're just like, I don't care how you do it, just do it. Okay. Go for it, computer. But hey man, what do I know? Anyway. Yeah. I feel like if people realized that everything is just like a little text file, and it's just like a bunch of text files strung together, and that's what's doing it all.
Yeah.
Their minds would break. Like, they'd be like, wait a second. It's like less than a Word document. You're like, yeah, it's got way less formatting in it than a Word document.
Oh, yeah. It's not, yeah. It's nowhere near as cool as HAL in 2001.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't even have a red blinking eye.
It's a slob. Unless you build a red blinking eye to have a red blinking eye.
Yeah.
Like, it's the poor use of your time. But, like, you know... who am I to judge? But anyway, yeah, I am just astonished by how credulous people are. Have you heard that? What's her name? Zuboff, I think. She wrote she was interviewed on Democracy Now. She wrote this book about how, you know, the sort of how powerful all this data analytics stuff was, and at no point. Was you know, she's not really a computer scientist, I don't think. So she's not to stereotype here, but I think she is in her 60s. And so it was largely viewed as sort of a recycling of just PR from companies. So if you take every company at their word, they're saying like, we're doing this thing and this thing definitely works. And it's definitely not just us like asking a bunch of lower paid gig workers in the Philippines to sort this information and apply metadata to it so that we can then run this much simpler computer algorithm. You know, that's definitely not what's happening. You know, we've got a technological process that runs itself, and we can, you know, or they'll say like, yeah, and then we change the outcome of an election, where it's like, well, you know, that's awfully hard to prove one way or the other, you know? So, but if you take, like a big data company at its word, they're like, oh yeah, yeah, we are infinitely powerful.
Sure.
I am so powerful. You should definitely invest. And that's exactly why they're communicating in that register. Right. So, but it was one of those things where, you know, this interview segment, it was terrifying, but then, you know, I have a hard time looking at the technologies that exist and thinking that any of it's actually true, right? Like, there's a reason why Amazon calls its piecework data production farm Mechanical Turk, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a complete revelation of exactly how this thing works from the behind part, right?
Yeah.
Like, you have to actually just go in and do it as like a from a purely mechanical perspective, like it was a person the whole time.
Yeah.
So, and it was and in the case of our friend Walter, it was a tiny person.
Yeah,
a wee person.
Well, because one example of this, or symptom of this, is that I feel like whenever you like look at dystopian films or literature about big computers or AIs, the bad things they do are just shit we already do to each other.
Right.
Like I read the Fear Index I read a couple years ago, which is...
What's that?
It's a piece of finance fiction about these like tech guys who build a computer to do like, you know, tiny trades every day. And it just, this is already a long, you know, this was speculative when he wrote it, but it's not anymore. You know, like, I forget what the field is called where you do micro trading. Computers can do enough of them a day that you actually make some money. But then, you know, the computer gets too smart. But then all it does is start to just like manipulate the market, where it'll like force a plane to crash and somehow bet against that. You know, it'll short the plane company. But I'm like, oh, we just do this anyway through like negligence.
Yeah.
We just like,
yeah.
Like, what's to keep the supposed AI from like, I don't know, developing a good relationship with ants or something? You know, I don't, why would it just try and kill us?
Yeah. Yeah. I also wondered the same thing too. Like, why does it want, well, I guess it depends on what it's trained on, but I mean, why does it want one thing or another thing? You know, it doesn't want anything.
No.
You know, and if it just wants to maximize trading value, then like perhaps it, you know, crashes an airplane or whatever, but like Boeing just did that anyway.
Yeah, they're doing it.
Yeah, they just crash airplanes. They make airplanes that don't fly to save money. So anyway.
Yeah, and we sell unfit planes that are unfit for flight to South American countries
easily
to keep flying until they crash.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, like, to maximize profit, so
we don't,
you know,
need this smokescreen of an AI to I guess maybe that's the thing, is that people in positions of power currently do need this smokescreen to keep the myth going.
Yeah, or at least to the idea that it's somehow different from what they're doing, so that they know that their job can't be automated.
Right.
You can't automate me. And you're like, actually, you know, what you're doing is maybe the most automatable thing of all. It's just like a pure sort of like, what can you do to make this line go up? Sort of numerical interaction, you know?
Sure.
But,
what can you do to cover it up when the line goes down?
Yeah. Or just same question, basically. Yeah. Oh boy. Well, on that cheerful note, thank you very much, Aaron, for coming by all the way from Berlin. And let's just call it a night before the robots come and take us all away.
Yeah. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good night.